Hello on this Yom Kippur. I come with gifts from my spouse, Fern. Please take one and pass them on. I wish I had more. I just don't have... So in some sense, the lesson of the day is to serve chocolates. Be living, not dying. One of the things I wanted to show you is a gift from Fern, in a sense, beyond these little chocolates. It's a game that she made in Scratch called One Cannot Play This Game. Let me see if I can do it. Come machine. My machine is moving slowly. While it moves, I would like to... Oh, here we go. Tell you about my daughter Rebecca, who is not here today because she's flying back from Chicago at this very moment and her plane is late. Fern is at the airport waiting for her to pick her up. I wanted to show you as well, but I think I'll perhaps do it by email, a program that Rebecca wrote, not in Scratch, but one that preceded it. If you Google Sheep Beats. Google Sheep Beats. See what you find. That's a program that Rebecca wrote. And I don't know why my machine is telling me that I can't show you Fern's program, but I'll have to come back to it. In fact, my whole machine seems to be dying right before my eyes. This could be a very serious problem. The dreaded blue screen. Well, I have here in front a screen, and on the other end of this screen is Jonathan Zittrain sitting in Oxford. And my plan for the day is to finish up. Let me just see if I can't correct my problem. To finish up the lecture that I ended with last week, and then in the break have us form into our groups, and in the time after to introduce John. Ah, at last, this is Fern's game. Will it play? I bet it won't. There's something seriously wrong with my machine. I'm in desperate shape. So I actually have a lot to cover, and I'm feeling my machine slowing me down, which is problematic. Empathetic arguments, the subject. We saw last week the Rodney King case and asked ourselves, could you see something differently? No, I'm looking good. Oh dear, what did I do? I'm destroying myself. I've done it wrong. All right, and now we have to go really quickly. Serve chocolates, one cannot play. You saw the front page. I'm not going to play it for you. The Battle of Algiers, it's a trailer. It puts you in the mind of the revolutionaries who led the battle for Algiers, done by Pontecorvo, an amazing piece of film, a pseudo-documentary that totally immerses you in the tension between the colonialist maintaining rule against a terror-wielding revolutionary force using the techniques of surveillance and torture. And it invites you to see it from a different point of view. So the lessons for us starting to think in rhetorical terms, thinking as potential lawyers in the court of public opinion about how persuasion works, can see that facts have their context. Context is crucial to how we see facts. The meaning we give often varies with point of view, and there are multiple ways to see them. So here, a big guy chasing a little guy. Look again. A big guy chasing a little guy. Look again. Everyone whose name begins with A, close your eyes. Oh, excuse me. A through M. A through M. Close your eyes. Now, everyone, close your eyes. Now, those who didn't have their eyes closed before, open them. Now, everyone, close your eyes. Now, open them. What is the age of the woman you see? Is she, how many would say a young woman? How many would say old? Huh. How did this happen? Look what you didn't see. Those who said young saw this. Those who said old saw that. You both looked at this, and you saw what you wanted to see. This is the lesson of the first stone. This is what we went through last week. This is called salience. Our own reasons, our own pains are more palpable, more obvious, more real to us than are the reasons and pains of others. That means we overestimate provocation coming in and underestimate pain going out. This leads to escalation, to the illusion that others are solely responsible for it, to belief that our actions are justifiable responses to theirs. So bang, we're the Necker cube. We can see things two ways. We can see the face of the cube blue. We can see it red. Can we see it a third way? Can you see the cube like this? Can you see the outer perimeter sitting flat against the plane and the two interior points coming up like mountains? So we build to mountain peaks our systems of belief. And we bridge the peaks with empathy, to empathize. It means to sense the hurt or the pleasure of another as she senses it. To perceive the causes thereof as she perceives them. But, and here's the hard part, but without ever losing the recognition that it is as if you were hurt or pleased, as if. So empathy, a definition, to perceive the internal frame of reference of another with accuracy and with the emotional components and meanings which pertain thereto as if one were the person, but never losing the as-if condition. All right, now, empathy in dispute resolution. One form in which we study dispute resolution is triangular. You're trying to persuade a judge. You have an opponent. The opponent's across the base of the triangle, the judge somehow up at the top. It's an environment in which we imagine the judge at the top to have power to dispose of our dispute. And persuading the judge is the win. That leads into a courtroom strategy, which is the core of the advocate's role in litigation. That is to tell your story, tell your client's story, tell your client's best story. Typically, that's going to be a story that starts where the client's story starts. So, for instance, if you're the criminal defendant, you will typically start your story at your point of arrest. Whereas if you are the prosecutor, you're going to start with the crime. But tell your best story. How do you tell your best story? Well, if I had to put my finger on what it is we try to teach in law school, it is how to tell your best story, how to discover it. I offer you two environments. First, the law school examination, the exam in which you're presented a problem and told to analyze it. How would you do that? Well, Here's the power of empathy applied to the problem. Tell me if this doesn't ring true. You read one of these problems. It's a justice story of some kind. You have an instinct as to who's right. Once you feel an instinct for who is right, that's the moment right then to empathize with the other side. Before you've crystallized anything beyond your instinct, empathize with the other side. Tell the story from the other point of view. Invest yourself in it, like theater. It's like method acting. Play it out, best you can. Then shift back to your original instinct, and then tell your story. When you're interviewing a client as a public defender, here, you've been assigned, your first meeting. How do you start your interview with your client? Do you ask the client, tell me your story? No. You start with the client from the point of arrest. And you interview the client as to everything that happened from the point of arrest on. Why? Because you want to know the prosecutor's story. That's the story you're up against. Your client's best story will be told in relation to the prosecutor's best story. Empathy in dispute resolution. In situations where there's no judge, situations where it's just the other, wooing the other. Start by serving chocolates. People will tell you that quite seriously. People who are in the business of wooing others will say, if you're going into advertising meeting and you want to sell your program and you've got the decision makers assembled, pass out chocolates at the beginning. A little sugar high is very good for their receptivity. So start with something nice. If you have the facility, start with a joke. It's the least intrusive. It improves the other's space. Are there any of those chocolates left? Excellent. Thank you. Has Zitrain appeared on the... No, not yet. Sorry, my mouth was getting dry. That's really good. That helps. So, yes. In the dyadic situation, if you can, you start with the other's story. You have a dispute. Somehow, you see the world one way, the other sees the world another. You want to move the other in some direction. It helps to be flexible yourself. It helps not to have the feeling that you are totally locked into your spot and you have no choice in dealing with the other, but to bring the other all the way to your point of view, even though you don't yet see any particular compromise. But start by telling the other's story. Why do you do that? You do that because as the other hears her story told, she pays attention. She listens. She wonders, does he really understand? And at the point where she is persuaded that you do, she is ready to listen to you and look for some ground that will actually work to resolve the dispute. So, now we want to take a break. And during the break, we want to form up groups. The idea of these groups is this. First, I want each one of you in our class to adopt your personal project, your argument, your piece of advocacy, the other that you want to engage. I'm happy if it's at a small level. I'm happy if it's at a large level. Then I'm going to ask you to tell the other's story and then tell me yours. In paper, on text, regular old essay form. And then, having done that, and having related to me somewhat about that, I am hoping that you will work in groups with each other to help each other express your argument in some form of cyber media. That's the idea. So, may we take a break, and we'll come back after and go with Jonathan Zittrain. So here, wait a second, I didn't quite get the instruction clear. The instruction is form groups.
How big?
I'd say six is max. What you want is you want something, you want to be able to get together. You want it to be fun. You want to feel good about working on and talking with the other people. I'd say, oh, hi, Becca. Just in time for our group formation.
It's true.
How long does break time last?
I'd say 5 minutes.
Okay.
Could be a little longer.
Okay.
I mean, the kids are talking. I like it. That's a good way it goes. Rebecca has an announcement.
Actually, just two quick announcements. First of all, thank you so much to everybody for being good sports, especially the people who came at 8 o'clock on Thursday. There was a certain amount of chaos, which Rodica said is actually sort of par for the course when you start up with Second Life, so maybe that was a reasonable experience for some of you guys to have. And those of you who haven't done it yet, there's still an opportunity on tomorrow night to do it. And I just wanted to announce for anybody who's not receiving emails for the course, people who are in this in-room class, but who for whatever reason are not on the official email list, go to this URL that's up on this board here and sign up. And this is only for the people who are in this class, so if you're watching on the video, please don't go and sign up at this URL. I've set up the list so that only I can post to it, so you should no longer have the problem of people replying to it and getting lots and lots of emails that you don't need. Okay, that's all.
Thank you. Now, Jonathan, are you there in some way? Look at that. Hello, how are you?
I'm well, how are you?
Can we get, if you can't hear, how do I turn the volume up here?
I can hear you fine. Can you hear me?
Yeah, well, we're working on it. Speak.
There's probably a button that says volume.
You think? Well, somebody heard that. Well, hey, Z.
Yes, sir.
I am hoping that you can somehow take us on a short little trip into what I think of as a form of generativity, the idea of an idea catching on the net and magnifying with exponential viral effect, network effect. What do you got?
Well, the way you put the question, if we were to put it into a single word, it's probably the word buzz. That immediately, in my mind, tends to put it into the zone of public relations and marketing and all the things that people who believe there's some legitimate, genuine grassroots component to the net are already wrestling with. You know, how do you generate buzz? Now, of course, even in the grassroots, you may want to get a message out. But to me, one question is, are we viewing ourselves as producers or just as consumers? And in most instances of surfing around on the net or otherwise using these machines, we're thinking of ourselves as consumers, often of other people's work. But even with something, say, like Wikipedia, my guess is for most of the people in the room, 9 times out of 10, or even 10 times out of 10, you're reading and browsing rather than editing and creating. So to me, what I see is a trend where online people feel some sense of ownership or of ability to contribute to a given community, and that tends to get them really excited. It's a complete inversion of sort of the amphitheater style seating that people are in right now, and the idea that perhaps you and Rebecca sort of are putting on a show once or twice a week and people come in and they kind of assess it. And trying to get people to think of it in a different mode, to me, is a precursor to really understanding what buzz is about. So let me just try to give you a couple examples. And to me, these examples share the trajectory of there's some spark where people who thought that they were mere consumers discover that there's something more going on. In some way, your expectation is exceeded with some activity you're doing online. And kind of like, wow, that's cool, that's fun, I'd like more of that. Then another phase is sort of what I'd call persistence, the idea that it wasn't just a one-off fluke, but that, wow, there might be other people in the world that you're meeting through this medium that aren't lunatics or axe murderers, and you find that you're sharing something with them, maybe not your name, but something else. Everybody has something different in mind with that. And then some form of success such that those zones of activity, or whether it's programming activity or social activity through this distributed network, when they get so successful, people start telling their friends, and then their friends tell their friends, and then you get into this meme of, there goes the neighborhood. The riffraff have shown up. God, this community was so much more fun 3 weeks ago before the rest of the world knew about it, and now it's all gone to hell, and, you know, how do we survive? And I think that kind of thing holds true. I mean, I should just pull the room quickly. How many people have actually heard of A Small World? Is it .net or .com? Anybody?
One.
So I'm about to maybe have that neighborhood go, because now you're the riffraff. Yeah, let me see if this works. You're not seeing anything, are you?
Blue, seeing blue.
Yeah, no, that's not what I meant to show you. your own technical problems have crossed the ocean. I was going to show you the website for asmallworld.net.
Well, hold on in 1 second.
No, I'm gonna figure this out. Okay, let's see if this works. All right, well, that's a field in which dancing sheep could be. That's what I meant to show you, but it's not really that parsable, is it?
Well, I can. Well, I've got it up on the screen, though, John.
Oh, well, then you don't need me to have it crappily on my screen. So hang on a second. All right, now you've got me crappily on my screen. So, A Small World starts with the premise that a handful of cool people, they are axiomatically cool, are gathering to first showcase their links to each other, right? So it's kind of like, it's Friendster. And it's like, all right, we've all showcased our links. What happens next? And the answer of Friendster, the answer is nothing, and then Friendster dies. But in the answer of A Small World, it's like, well, wouldn't it be great so that you could put your travel schedule into it, and then friends or friends of friends in Paris know when you're coming through and can offer you a place to stay, that kind of thing. And how do we grow the network? We have people who are already in it invite their closest friends and promise that they won't let in any riffraff. And that's how A Small World has developed. And interestingly, for those interested in the difference between rule and standard, the standard is you're not supposed to sell admission to A Small World on eBay. That would be riffraffy. Riffraff with money, but riffraff nonetheless. And you're not supposed to let too many new people in at once. So I'm actually happy to test the confines of this world by giving anybody in the class who wants one an invitation to A Small World, where I can even just give a few, and then you guys could continue the invitations. And before you know it, we will run that universe.
Well, why don't you just give us your username and password, and then we can all play?
Yeah, I don't know. I have so many usernames and passwords for services that I don't really care about that I inevitably forget what they are and have to guess through about 13, and then they lock my account and have to send me a new bank card. So this instinct to gather and to find meaning and connection with other people, you see it expressed in lots of ways. Now, so far I've just talked about A Small World, which is a very self-conscious community of this sort. Sometimes the communities are accidental. I think in some ways the free software movement is an accidental community of people for which absolutely they have a riffraff detector. They try to make sure that you know Linux before you start, say, hacking on Linux. But other than that, you're open and able to contribute to that. And I suspect that many people see them work on free software as much as a social activity as they do a sort of technical activity. And the same goes for Wikipedia. It's as much a social thing as an intellectual thing. I don't know if anybody was at the Wikimania conference here at HLS in August. Right on the other side of Pound Hall, I sat in on one of the rare physical gatherings of the Wikipedia Arbitration Committee. And the Arbitration Committee was sort of the elders of Wikipedia who have some power to decide in a big dispute whether a user should be suspended from Wikipedia or locked out or dead to Wikipedia. That's the ultimate thing, sort of erasing the fact that the user was ever even there, cutting them out of the picture, Don Corleone style. And it was just great to see this committee gathered, people revering these people who otherwise, like Central Casting asked you to send, you know, the nerds from X-Files over, that's what you would get. And they were still incredibly compelling, socially powerful people in that space. As people asked questions of them, they would say their own wiki name, because of course Wikimania was mostly a gathering of Wikipedians. So somebody would say, you know, hi, I'm Mothball15, and there'd be this brief pause, and people would go, wow, that's Mothball15. And it'd be kind of like a murmur as people like, you know, who knew that he, you know, had a mullet or whatever it was. And then that would die down, and then, you know, Mothball would ask his question, and they would get back to business. So there's this interesting blend of the social and the technical. But I think that many of the typical forms, I think in your first class you talked a little bit about, I don't know if I may summarize it with some butchery to it, corporations are running the world and that's a bad thing. Was that part of your first day?
Until balanced.
Yeah, that's right, okay. That's sort of a bad thing and let's just have them run half the world. And here, when corporations try to get into the space and cultivate community, it can be very hard because people really do like to feel a sense of their own ownership in it. And I don't know whether the lesson to corporations, therefore, is to sort of back off and let the communities do their things, or if it's, no, no, if we can just fake the sincerity a little better, then we'll have had it made. So other phenomena worth talking about, I don't have to talk about them all right now, but Wikipedia certainly is one, the Free Software
Well,
movement,
John,
just, talked about.
John, yeah. Just stop right there.
Yeah.
What you're saying has to do with this very difficult line to identify between being sincere and appearing to be sincere. This idea that tell the truth and when you learn to fake it, you've got it made, kind of an idea.
Right.
And yet, in some way, the essence of rhetoric, which is at the base of the power of message, has to do with the character of the speaker and the credibility with which he or she speaks. And so I'm listening for some encouragement from you and some connection to the idea of buzz, that there be an element of truth at the bottom of the message.
Well, not necessarily truth, because part of the lesson, I think, is that we're collectively figuring out what truth is and what established truths are okay to challenge. But in persistent identity, I mean, when you talk about one's character, you're talking about where do you come from and who are you? Now, I think to some, that's a belief that you actually have to be personally identified in order to be given credit online. Oh My News. Has anybody talked about Oh My News yet?
No, nobody.
Are people familiar with Oh My News? Feel free to surf to Oh My News. Just Google it and feel lucky. Oh My News started in South Korea. It is a newspaper that is wildly popular there, and the articles are authored by citizen journalists. And the normal shtick you'd hear from the typical person who thinks internet is great and community is great and everything is new is, wow, citizens get together, they write articles, and out comes a newspaper. Editors pay them a few bucks, so there's even a financial model to it. But the line between citizen and journalist is finally eliminated. I think there's some. Whoa, I even heard that. Part of what makes Oh My News work is that, and I remember I was actually at this Google Zeitgeist conference at this wildly posh resort where Google just spent a big pile of money and invited a bunch of people, including the founder of Oh My News, to talk about power to the people in this wonderfully elitist atmosphere. And I asked him, well, how do you deal with the fact that there might not be truth in your articles? That, in fact, the market is such, as we know, that the more outrageous the article is, the more readers it might get. And he said, oh, well, that's easy. We have people give their national ID number before we publish the article. So in South Korea, you actually have to give your full identity, and should you mess up once and print something wrong, then, you know, you're dead in this town. You'll never publish an Oh My News again. So that's a very traditional way of assuring a certain ethos of a speaker. My own view is that pseudonymity can go a long way as long as it has persistence. And an example of that is eBay. You don't necessarily know who the seller is, but the sellers and buyers are supposed to have longitudinal records of thumbs up and thumbs down. And the new people, I for a while didn't know what this icon was. When you just sign on to eBay, they give you an icon of shades, which I thought meant you were cool, and then you stop being cool. But in fact, it means you're shady, you're suspicious, you're sketchy. And perhaps you shouldn't buy a plasma TV from somebody who's still wearing shades. And most of the online communities, I think, that function well over rhetorical standpoint, that as you would say, tend towards moderation, are ones that permit persistent identity. So a great example going the other way are the comments on blogs or on YouTube videos, which really show you a side to humanity that it's just like, wow, you know, sometimes 12-year-olds really are better seen and not heard. other modes, including Wikipedia, tend to try to balance between people wearing shades. If you're just an IP address, you can make an edit, but not all the time, and maybe your edit will be more quickly reverted than if you have a long record of making edits, but that has some sense of kind of continuing participation. And that, to me, is part of the line between a town hall and a mob, between people who actually have a stake in what they're saying to each other, they value their reputation in that community, and they will feel hurt if somehow they let the community down or if they get kicked out of it. And you can then walk through the different online communities and you can see which ones are that way and which ones aren't. Everything from eHarmony to blogs to the other stuff we've been talking about.
So, John, it puts me in mind of Neuromancer, Gibson's amazing novel, and the reputation server as at the core of the society. Somehow, as you move in this space, your credibility goes with you, at least to some extent.
I think that's true, and in fact, you might want to start asking who runs the reputation server. So, for example, online dating, it's important to have some sense of ethos before you actually meet somebody who might be an axe murderer. I guess something like eHarmony, at least from the ads, promises that they give you like the Myers-Briggs test and they promise to only put ENTJs with people that like that. Where was I going with all that? Reputation servers.
I tell you what.
Can I just get a last sentence?
Yeah, go.
Yeah. That some of those sites are now letting people essentially do a TiVo thumbs up or thumbs down button after their date. So afterwards, you're just like, you know, was that person cool or not? And if you didn't like them, then the system will sort of indicate to everybody else that they're kind of lame. And then you'll get people that are lame and people that aren't. And who runs this server? And who hacks this server? And if you work for eHarmony, can you make yourself not lame, even if you are? And I think we're going to see more and more of that, not just in dating transactions, but in all sorts of human contact transactions, and figuring out how to make those servers and reputations fair. How to let people declare reputation bankruptcy after they've decided to go into rehab, personality rehab, and, you know, they're ready for another go-around, will be one of the important questions.
Can I just take a tech second just to figure out the microphones? Is it correct that Jonathan can only hear my father's microphone? Or can he hear this one too?
No, it's
I think they might good enough that if anybody even if her student were to bellow, I'd probably hear it.
All right, that sounds great.
The TV's a room microphone and one you're holding is for the camera, and one you're mic with is for the camera. One you're holding is for the room.
So if
this
we
is
want to
room.
Pass the mic around to students, we have to pass both mics to the students and they have to talk near both of them. Is that right?
Let's do it. We're eager, what we're saying, to open the floor to Jonathan and back and forth amongst ourselves on the subjects of today. And
I'm also eager to ask one question to you also. Just a question about the other side of the identity thing. It seems to me that some things have developed a large amount of buzz without any specific identities being attached to them, but just more because there are a lot of different people, maybe without a solid identity, who are interested in it. And I don't have a good example, but I'm just wondering what you think about that.
Well, a good example might be anything that ends up bouncing around the blogosphere. My God, it's the hamster dance. How many people have heard of the hamster dance? Okay, now how do we explain this? It's not that funny. It's crappy graphics, and yet we've all seen it. Somehow a hamster dance has buzz, and I think if you go to hamsterdance.com, there's like ads and stuff. Like, you know, like the hamster dance guy has a house in Bel Air now. Maybe that's your question, Becca? Like, what's with hamster dance?
I guess my question is whether the identity aspect of it is really necessary in order to create buzz for something. Maybe in order to create a community where you have specific personal relationships, but for the situation where you're going to watch some video, maybe you just care that there were a million people who said that it was really cool, even if they are 12-year-olds.
Yeah, I think that certainly there can be buzz without community. But one, it tends to put it into the realm of who's a better marketer and PR person. The answer to that question for a new modality is not PR and marketing people who tend to be risk-averse schmucks that don't go near new modalities. But once the path is blazed, then I think the grassroots gives over to AstroTurf. And, you know, at the moment the Pope started a blog, it's just like, okay, how cool are blogs? I don't mean any offense to the Pope, of course. I'm just saying that's an example of a mainstream person, okay? It doesn't get more Catholic than the Pope. And that's why I think for the long term, we want to say, yes, maybe buzz you can get without community in the beginning, but once the thing becomes known and everybody sees that Dancing Hamsters works, then suddenly Dancing Hamsters won't work anymore, or the buzz will go to the person with the most money.
So that's pretty interesting then. It's that there really is this effect of having to be at the cutting edge with something so that you can catch people's attention. So then I wonder whether it's really about truth or whether it's about having something there that people are interested in when they finally get down to whatever the buzz is about. And I wonder what Lonely Girl 15 sort of, and the fact that it turns out to be fake in the end, tells us about that.
How many people are familiar with Lonely Girl 15? Not that many.
About half.
Most of you are familiar but just don't want to admit it. So that was a phenomenon on YouTube. Of course, YouTube has all of these videos and very crude systems for videos gathering momentum, including the most watched video. Now, of course, there's a barn in Connecticut, which is known as the most photographed barn in Connecticut, and tourists go to it and take pictures of it, thereby ratifying its status. And similarly, on YouTube, you get the most watched video of the day, and then people go to see, well, what's the most watched? That must be good. And it is this sense of everybody looking up on a New York City sidewalk, and as you pass, you look up, and then people pass you, and you know, that kind of thing. That can be manipulated, and Lonely Girl 15 is an example of something that it's not clear how it got its initial buzz going. I think it started linking to and replying to existing videos that had buzz, and then the content appeared curious, compelling, strange enough to people that then they started passing it around through the usual blog, email channels, and it doesn't hurt that the mainstream media, the New York Times, featured it several times, and then suddenly even Wikipedia, which had scheduled a vote for deletion of the Lonely Girl 15 article that somebody had created because she was just another emo kid on YouTube, then had to, a week later, retake the straw poll, and it was unanimous, obviously we should keep it. And interesting that a lot of the Wikipedians who were against it, because they thought it wasn't interesting and they thought it wasn't notable, changed their votes, able to separate their own view from the larger question of, does this thing actually have buzz? And by then, Lonely Girl 15 did.
He got a fellowship to study medicine at the University of Oxford. My mom, who was 2 years younger, was studying in Edinburgh, which is in Scotland.
I thought that was a question, and then I realized it was Lonely Girl 15.
She was on weekends because she was doing her dissertation on Johann Weyer. She would study at the British...
Go ahead, Quan Bull.
Yes, Professor Zittrin. I'm picking up to from you what sounds like a real disparity. Almost, if I don't know how to characterize it. I guess this is my question. I'd ask you to characterize it between the completely seemingly open nature of this buzz that is something gains momentum and it catches on. It seems that that could happen to anything. That's completely open. And yet you showed us this a small world thing where, as in Facebook, as in Second Life, as in all these things, people are trying to recreate the country club, which is keep it closed and exclusive. How do you characterize this difference?
I think the difference, and it's a good question, and I'm not sure I'll fully get it with the answer, but I think the difference is between the transitory, ephemeral, hey, look at this, you know, it's a cat flushing the toilet. I haven't seen that in a while.
Right? How many of you saw that on YouTube when it was like the most watched video for a given week, a few weeks ago? There's a certain just, it's almost, how would we put it in constitutional law? We would call it prurience, right? The notion of prurience, which is, it excites me and yet I'm embarrassed about that, right? That's kind of one category of buzz. And I think that's sort of a short-term phenomenon for each of the buzzes. The second category of stuff is meant to be more enduring. It's where you actually invest part of your identity in a thing that is larger than you are. So if all YouTube were a collection of cats flushing toilets, metaphorically and literally speaking, if it went down one day, if you just went to go to YouTube and there was no more YouTube, you know, some copyright suit took it down, you'd just be like, meh, all right, you know, I guess I have to do my work or read the paper or, you know, do something else. Whereas if you had very carefully groomed your identity in Facebook and specified your friends and scribbled notes and they'd scribbled notes on you, and then some huge change takes place in that environment that was without notice and that completely alters your experience, Facebook news feeds, the outrage is somehow bigger than the sum of the parts. It's not just an outrage of my functionality here has changed and I don't like it. In fact, people got more functionality. It was somehow feeling like something in which they had invested themselves had been wrested out of their control. And the story that that then generated of people made a petition to Facebook by joining the Facebook group, I don't like the news feeds, or joined the group, enough already with you not liking the news feeds, that somehow has a spark to it. That's the difference between perceiving Howard Dean as a sideshow carnival barker, kind of, you know, Ross Perot crazy person, and Howard Dean as the indicator of a grassroots movement that finally my voice, which had previously not been represented by one of John Kerry or W, now my voice has found a place. And, you know, which is Dean? That's, as I think Nesson would say, that's a Necker Cube kind of question. It depends on where you stand, how represented you already feel, how entitled you feel. But I guess my claim is that enduring buzz comes from that second category of stuff rather than the prurient stuff.
Have we got another question from the crowd?
All right, here's another one, Jonathan. So how do we do it? I mean, everybody just formed groups. They're going to have some issues, some stuff to create buzz about. How would you advise people to go about thinking about how to get started with that first mysterious step?
Can I ask a follow-up to that?
And a follow-up.
A related question would be, has anyone ever successfully meant to start buzz and then done it? We've talked about a phenomenon that someone meant to start the viral thing.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, sometimes it happens easiest when you don't mean to. But it can also happen when you set out to do something. I mean, you know, you very self-consciously get a bunch of guys together and say, we hold these truths to be self-evident. And, you know, before you know it, it's Schoolhouse Rock. I mean, yes, there are times when you will really work to create a new thing. And an example which maybe serves as a counter story is, are people familiar with ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers? Right, there was a time, and if you take Cyber 2, you'll hear about this at some point, there was a time when the domain name system was basically run by one guy in sandals in California. And it's not too much exaggeration to say that if the plug was kicked out of his Macintosh, the internet would go down. That was like way back in 1996. And then it was decided that this was a little too casual and something more was needed. And nobody wanted to step forward to say, well, I should run the internet because who gave them the right? And a meeting was called. I have to use the passive voice here because nobody knows who called it, at least at first we didn't, in Reston, Virginia, of the International Forum on the White Paper, which was a document by the Department of Commerce that said that somebody should step forward to run the domain name system, a grassroots effort. And so everybody showed up at this meeting in Reston to watch. I went, and you'd say to people, what are you doing here? And they'd say, I'm just here to see what happens. I'm not saying I'm part of it. I'm just, wait and see. And everybody was watching, and nobody was there to do anything. And then at some point, that lure of the whiteboard was irresistible. Somebody started squeakily writing things, and people were talking and debating. And before you know it, you actually had a meeting of people, and business cards were exchanged, and you had started a community. So all the way back to Becca's question of what does it mean to have a group here, I think it means that the task has to first feel non-arbitrary. It's going to feel arbitrary at first because you've just been told to form groups. You didn't do it on your own accord. And at best, the kind of reason to do it at first may seem because, I don't know, we're going to get graded on what we do, and now I'm in another one of these stupid group exercises where everybody else is a free rider and I'm doing all the work. Which, of course, is exactly what Nesson described at the beginning of perceiving harm to you more acutely than what you give out to everyone else. So if you can cross the line from cynical to, wow, maybe this would work, it's that movement that is the difference between failure and success. And there was some moment when Wikipedia crossed the line from totally lunatic, what a waste of time for anybody to hack on it, into, a very powerful online force. So here, I would think it would be, what do the people in these groups have in common? What are they actually going to generate that might matter to themselves or to the world? And how do you deal with outliers? How do you deal with people in the group who aren't down with the program or who would rather be doing something else or just have a very different view? And I think if you can answer those questions, that's how to answer your main question.
So, Jonathan, I want to jump in with an answer to that last question myself to some extent. The question of starting Buzz on purpose. Well, I'm just going to tell you about it. John, I've gotten interested in the story of Marcus Garvey.
No one remembers old Marcus Garvey.
Very few people do. He is actually the first national hero.
Nobody remembers that song either. Sorry.
Was that a song?
Yes, a song by the title, No One Remembers Old Marcus Garvey.
Really?
At some point, even my Simpsons references are going to seem stale.
Extraordinary. So, I've gotten interested in this story for a number of different reasons, but it is a story of someone who set out to start Buzz and who went about it in a very methodical way and was remarkably successful in starting Buzz on the idea of unifying African people in an association, a global association, that would function in a way to lift black people out of their poverty. And the story of Marcus Garvey is such an extraordinary one because it was so successful in many ways. His philosophy of black is beautiful, his regard for black women, his raising of the idea of self-development to the level of political reality to which he brought it, with huge parades and a shipping line that went from port to port with great crowds greeting the ships as they came in. This idea of establishing a true commerce was incredibly powerful. It was taken down more or less by J. Edgar Hoover and by Garvey's own mismanagement. At core, he was not an excellent businessman, so he was a flawed character. But in terms of his conceptualization of black commerce and black God and black pride. He is the precursor of any number of black leaders and black movements. Malcolm X directly, Malcolm X's parents were both Garveyites, Stokely Carmichael, the list simply goes on. And yet this man like Hector has been forgotten, his reputation traduced by a mail fraud prosecution brought by J. Edgar Hoover as one of actually the first assaults on citizen organization that he led. But just a very interesting example of someone who set out to understand the way media communication works, who expressed himself in the media of the time. He generated his own newspaper, Negro World, and distributed it widely throughout the world. And along with it generated a philosophy, an organization, and potentially offered huge promise with it. I've become interested in it because I'd love to somehow be part of an effort that Charles Ogletree is joining. I'm joining him, and we're both joining an enterprise that has been invited by the Prime Minister of Jamaica and led by a man who's the chairman of the government department at the University of West Indies, and in which I hope Alex and Diane will be participating, and I'm hoping that Cole, where is Cole? He's missing today, may participate in. Cole, there you are. And others. Sorry, go ahead.
I'm going to have to go in a minute. I'm actually meeting Julian DeBell next, who's a writer who's written, well, you can Google him, but he's really into virtual worlds, and you should totally ask him to be a guest, because I think he has a book he's hawking now, so he should come. But I was going to say what you remind me of is the fact that so far there's still such a power of leadership in the space. Somebody with a strong and clear voice, and maybe even a degree of certainty about what they're about that exceeds the level of certainty that by all rights they ought to have, that's a maybe neither necessary nor sufficient condition for success in the space, but it's correlated with it. And you look at the kinds of leaders in the blogosphere, and they have a certain certainty to them about what they say that they probably ought not to have, but that is very, very compelling. And I think that's true of, you know, Joshua Micah Marshall or Juan Kett or Gawker or Lonely Girl 15. And I think it's true in some ways of Jimbo Wales, who's an example of somebody, the way you describe Marcus Garvey. I'm reminded of a SIG file that used to be on Hal Abelson's email, which was, if I haven't seen as far as others, it is because others were standing on my shoulders. And sort of the idea that when you stand on the shoulders of giants, at some point, you know, well, somebody is the giant in that scenario, and others stand on it. And I think Jimbo actually is a great example of somebody who has such a great following because he is so modest about his own participation, even though in some important respects he runs Wikipedia with an iron fist.
Jonathan, thank you very much for your participation. Please say hello to Julian for me. I should tell everyone. Yep, thank you, John.
Serious about the small world thing if you want, but don't expect that there's much there. I haven't logged in a long time.
Julian Dibble was the first person that I heard really lecture on the economy of virtual worlds.
That's what his book is about. He's got a new book out just about that.
Yes.
So you ought to at least invite him to Second Life or something. He's probably heard of it.
Thank you, Z.
Okay, bye, thanks.
So what did we think of this experience? Here we were, talking with a professor at Oxford. And it was limited. I mean, we could have had it up on the big screen. But it was nice to have a big screen that you could kind of go along in back of them with. Yes, here, Gary, pass the microphone up. Which one? This one.
I really didn't have anything that insightful to say, but I thought it was great. The volume could be louder, but that's not really a complaint about, I mean, I think it's amazing that we can talk to him, and knowing how far technology has come since the day that these, you know, we first had these cameras, it seems incredible, because it used to be that doing communication through these, it was very pixelated, and it was just very jumpy, that you wouldn't be able to follow what was going on, the feed would go in and out constantly, so to see the improvements that they've made on this is astounding, and it makes it much more interactive when you can actually ask a question in real time. It's coming back to you as opposed to the way it used to be when it would be 2 minutes between the question and someone else answering.
That's true, and yet it's equally true. You can look at it from the other side and see how easily we could improve it. And why don't we? You know, it's like that's always the question. It's almost always the question. Well, why don't we just do what we're doing a little better? Yes, some questions from the groups. I recommend that you proceed on an individual basis, but I don't absolutely require it. If there is some other aggregation of effort that will make sense to you in going forward to develop an argument and then share it with a group and project it out, I am open to it. But I recommend that you approach it individually and take advantage of the opportunity just to confront the problems yourself of seeing from the other's point of view. If it makes more sense to do it with a friend, do it with a friend. But I recommend that you do it individual. Other questions about the group activity? Yes?
I'm really confused about what we're supposed to do.
Yeah. I want you to focus on something you'd like to see change or some action that's impending that you would like to stop. It can be something that is, I would like it to have some element of dispute to it so that there is a position that you're in and there is positions opposed. And I would like you to undertake an approach to making your argument for change by starting by telling the opposition's story. And having told the opposition's story, then proceed to tell your own. When I talked about interviewing the client, the person who's your criminal defendant when you first see him, and starting at the point of the story that you care about, it has to do with learning how your opposition sees the case that you've got. And your client is by far the best discovery tool that you have as to what the prosecutor knows. So everything that was said in the presence of the client by anyone to the prosecutor or to the police is what you want to get into. So your first step in figuring out what your line of attack is to understand what the story is that's going to be coming against you. Then you can figure out how to go. Later on, it may make sense to ask your client, well, now tell me the story from the beginning. When the client tells that story, having just told you everything the prosecutor knows, chances are improved you're going to get a good story. And chances are improved that you're going to have, as a lawyer, less struggle with your client in the dialogue back and forth as to what is the most penetrating story to break through the prosecutor's story in opposition. So that idea of first getting the story from the other side and getting it well enough so that you really understand it, and then making your argument back to it, so that if you can get to the point where you feel, okay, I've got a winning argument against that best story, you've answered the exam. You have written the excellent brief. You have made an effective argument. That's in that court situation. If you look at it dyadically, you just need to persuade. I like the dyadic because it's got this cyber quality to it. In cyberspace, no personal jurisdiction. There's no judge with a club. You're dealing with people who have freedom in the sense that they can pick up and leave. The net, you can go elsewhere. Buzz means you've got to attract in. All right, so the idea in that environment is you tell the other story. You tell it so well that they sit back and show you that they see that you understand. And then they're ready to listen. Then you tell your story. That's what I'm looking for. It's that exercise of, to me, the essential lawyer skill that I am hoping to communicate to you, both as something that you take command of in the most traditional form and something that you can put to work in this wider environment. Now, just what it is, it's almost unimportant to me, as long as it's important to you. I would ask yourself, what is your passion? Connect with your passion. Yes, Christina. Where's the mic?
It's okay, go ahead.
Okay, so my question is this issue that we're supposed to be, you know, like influencing others about, does it have to be something that the public is interested in, since we're supposed to be a class of public opinion, or something that maybe you're trying to garner public support for, but it's to a limited audience? Like, I guess what's the intended audience for our issue?
I guess it's for you to choose in some way. I think it's for you to choose. All right, so let's end the moment early. Yep, wait a second. Becca?
When is it due at Haddon Watts?
To be announced. I'll put it up. When would it make sense? When would it make sense in terms of the kinds of schedules that you've got? I mean, this isn't to write something out like this. What is it, a week? Is it 2 weeks? I mean, I'm looking for something at the order of like 1,500 words. You know, long op-ed maybe, something that's got 2 weeks. All right, due in 2 weeks. Due in 2 weeks.
You also want it formatted in some sort of cyber medium?
No. 2 weeks, straight text. Straight text.
One other question, sorry. So can you just specify a little more what the group element of this is?
I'd love you to work together. I'd love you to be able to talk with each other. I would love it at the point where you take your argument and want to express it in a cyber media that you are able to share some skills amongst a group. That would be great. Collaboration is fine. This is not an exam. Yes?
So are we not sharing the same argument or, I guess, theory with the group?
With the group. No, I was thinking that the group would help each one express further. If the group wants to do it a little different, I'm open to suggestion. I'm really looking to engage maximum creativity on the objective. And if you've got a better suggestion for me, I'm open. But this is the frame that I'm suggesting. All right? Okay.